if you picture a watch, a self-winding watch, what happened there is that the winder in the watch was broken, and we had to figure out how to wind that, get the watch so it could wind itself again. And if we have a recession this time, it's going to be because the watch is broken, you know, the gears, because there's so many pieces that are in a fragile condition right now. We've got shortages like you've described, cars that can't get built, just about anything that needs to be built that has computers, chips in it, or that has various kinds of metal products in it that are produced in, you know, other countries, or that are produced in our country but are short of workers. We just have a confluence of so many broken parts or breaking parts in the economy that to fix the economy this time involves a great deal more complication. Last time it was, let's get the interest rates low, let's kind of stoke the economy with money coming in the top. But if we stoke this economy with money, what we'll end up doing is driving up prices because everything is short in supply.
You know, Sandy, what the impact then, because it's global, right? I mean, this is not just what's happening in the United States. If you listen to conservatives, they lead you to believe that the only place this is happening is in this country. But this is a global problem. And so what is the impact of that going to have? I mean, even if we were able to come out of it and the rest of the globe still remains in it, I mean, that's going to retard us coming out of it, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, it's a global problem. And that's the other problem with this particular. Last time, in 2008, the problem was American-based, and when we sneezed, the rest of the country, the rest of the world caught a cold. This time, we're all coming down with a contagion at the same time. Europe is suffering the same sort of inflation and shortage situation we are. China's is on the verge of a recession because of the pandemic and the shutdowns there and the resulting problems there. Those two economies, the European economy and the Chinese economy, are the things that help support the U.S. economy because it's all interrelated. So if all three of those economies go into recession for different reasons, it gets a lot more complicated.
Yeah, but it gets a lot more complicated, but the bloodletting is going to be even more severe.
Well, that's what I mean by complicated. It's harder to fix. It takes
yes.
a longer time.
So, Sandy, if at the time, again, and I'm saying I'm looking at this from the perspective of, you know, the average Joe and what they're going to have to deal with through all of this, there is no quick fix for the gasoline prices. We're going to have to live with them for a while, right? There is no quick.
I think gasoline prices are less worrisome to me than the shortage of parts for automobiles and the complications in the supply chain. Gasoline's a commodity, and commodities go up and down in price, and the price of oil is going to come down.
The average person is really suffering with that gasoline price, and it's not going to come down overnight, you know. And I know, you know, when I go and fill the tank up and it's $80, and then you look a few days later and it's another $80, and you know, and all of a sudden you look and you're spending the equivalent of a car note. Simply for gasoline, you know, people who don't have the luxury of having a couple different vehicles, but they've got one, and that becomes a real burden for a family that's struggling just to get around. I'm not saying that the gasoline price, Sandy, isn't going to at some point in time go down, but it can't go down fast enough for people who are struggling just to, you know, to get back and forth to work.
Well, that is true. I mean, the American economy, for better or for worse, we built the American economy around the automobile and around gasoline beginning in 1955 when we started the whole interstate system and took out all of our our intra-urban system. You know, if we had streetcars right now, it wouldn't be such a problem if you could jump on a streetcar instead of filling your car with gas.
That is correct. But you know, I guess they couldn't see everything, and I guess nobody could foresee this. But Sandy, even knowing that we're at this point, and can you blame it all on Joe Biden and Democrats?
Well, no, of course. Well, no, I mean, it's been a confluence. First of all, you have to point at the tax reduction that started this whole process. Our government, since 2008, has been trying to create a vibrant, strong economy by spending far more than was taken in revenues, and has been doing a bunch of things which in the long run everyone knew had the potential to be inflationary. And then on top of that, you know, and that was all working all right. The economy was getting hot with low interest rates, and we still didn't have inflation, but all we needed was a little bit of shortage, and that we found that. You know, we found shortage with the pandemic, we found shortage with the supply chain disruptions, we found shortage with the tariff policy that began that process. And we found shortage with the pandemic, which was obviously not a partisan process. Maybe the way we handled it might have been partisan, but it was experienced worldwide. What's happened is that the business cycle has run a course, and it's run its course all the way now to something which is predictable, which is inflation, but it's inflation on steroids because of the shortages.
You know, Sandy, that sounds frightening to me when you add all those other components that you are talking about, and that the business has run, this thing has run its cycle. So what replaces it, Sandy, and that replacement of what that was, how long does it take before that reaches the average person?
Well, I guess to some extent, the problem is that the average person, the worker, the cogs in this process, are the ones that experience the business cycle, and they don't experience the upside anywhere near as much as they experience the downside.
Right,
and so it's going to happen again. You know, it's really unfortunate. And other economies, the European economies that have set up safety nets, have made it much less perilous to experience the business cycle. If your family has health care, and if your family has child daycare, and if you have education paid for, and if you have a retraining arrangement that comes to you and retrains you very aggressively, you're in a far better place than you are in our country when things get hard and it's each person to themselves.
You know, Sandy, it is a harrowing thought. But again, if you've been around a while, you remember, you know, harsh and hard times. But it's, you know, for some it'll be a new thing, but it's what our country is, it's what happens, and it's what the world is, all interconnected, and maybe the interconnectedness of it, Sandy, is what, you know, makes it so harrowing, because the interconnectedness of it means that everybody's going to be suffering.
Well, like I say, though, I think if our economy was better, if we had a socioeconomic system that was more balanced and it was more aimed at protecting Tom, Dick, and Mary, we can look to Europe to see the examples of it. I think this might actually ignite a fire under the political process to start paying attention to the people.
To valuing the people, you know.
Yeah, I mean, because the people are the ones who bear the brunt of the business cycle, and it maybe has taken me a long time instead of just looking at it with interest as an economist. If you look at it sociologically speaking, it is the workers and Tom, Dick, and Mary, the middle class, that suffer the slings and arrows of the business cycle. The wealthy might lose an appreciable portion of their wealth, but they don't suffer in a human sense.
You know, Sandy, I want to move to yesterday. I had a guest on who represented the Gun Owners of America, and so I had him on, and he came on and did a horrific job of representing the Gun Owners of America as we talked about the horrific situation that happened in Texas. And Sandy, what are your thoughts about the fact that an 18-year-old could walk into a gun shop and buy, and I know that it's legal, and buy a weapon of war? And as you see people pushing back on the term weapon of war, they don't like you saying that it's a weapon of war. Tucker Carlson had a fit about it the other day, saying, well, it's not a weapon of war, but whatever, that young man could go in and buy it and then buy 1,000 rounds of ammunition and then go back the next day and buy another one. Is you know, I know it's legal, Sandy, but does that make sense?
No. And in fact, a country having 400-plus million guns and having 20 million assault rifles out there in the public hands, first of all, you know, millions of assault rifles in the public hands, that's a bigger arsenal held by private individuals than our army has. I can assure you that the inventory of our army wouldn't include 20 million assault rifles. We never have more than 2 million in our standing army at once. So, you know, it's our country jumped off the tracks when we got all these guns and made them available, when we have public figures like Tucker Carlson, who can stand up and responsibly, he thinks, say that an AR-15 that can shoot, you know, 1,000 rounds of ammunition in a short period of time is not a weapon of war. What is it a weapon for? What possible good? And there are some who are now pointing out that they believe the Second Amendment is there so people can withstand their government with guns.
Yes.
So it's like constitutionally supported sedition.
Listen, we've got to go to a break. Sandy Williams is on the line, 844-967-2789. We'll come back to this on the other side. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. Be right back.